How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
We have been spoiled with some gorgeous sunshine lately. And summer in Chicago, I mean, it really seemed to come alive, didn't it? But some days have been much hotter and more sunny than others, with temps above 90 degrees. And for some, this heat, it brings back memories of July 1995. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Later this week marks 30 years since a dark moment in Chicago history, a story of heat, death, and blame after more than 700 people lost their lives.
You see things, but never, you know, on a magnitude like this. You wouldn't expect, you know, this much, you know, so many deaths, you know, just due to the weather.
It was all due to a brutal heat wave that didn't let up for 5 days.
Blistering, devastating, oppressive heat.
Temperatures have reached 100 degrees outside yesterday and probably today. It doesn't mean things are
it's
not
a crisis
up at City Hall as they are.
I know Chicago's not seen a crisis like this. We've seen a lot of things, but I don't think we've seen one like this.
But it wasn't just the heat. It was an overwhelmed power grid.
At about 4 in the morning, when power went out in a large portion of the city for a significant period of time, second outage, my husband, enraged, rose from a sweat bed.
It was the political panic.
We all have our little problems, but let's not blow it out of proportion.
And it was social isolation. Many of the victims lived alone, lacked air conditioning, and no one checked on them.
The problem are the people that don't call. We are talking about people that die because they neglect themselves.
Back in 1995, the heat wave felt like a one-off, something extreme and rare. But nowadays, heat waves aren't just more common. They're showing up earlier and sticking around longer. So what's the deal here? Just your typical Chicago summer? Are we prepared to handle this every June or July? Or have we pushed the memories of 95 so far back that we've missed the chance to learn from it? So we're going to go back to July 1995, when 739 people died in the city of Chicago as a result of the heat. And to learn more, I spoke to Eric Kleinenberg. He wrote a book on the topic called Heatwave, a Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. We started our conversation talking about what happened. I asked Eric what still sticks out to him and how this all went down back in 1995.
You know, I grew up in Chicago, and so I am accustomed to very hot summer days. Something I remember is hit 106 and felt like 126 for a typical person. But these days, I think we've grown accustomed to the fact that climate change means hotter summers and more dangerous weather. We see it this week, tragically. We see it every week. Mm-hmm. But I think the most puzzling thing that I still have trouble dealing with about that week in Chicago is that, on the one hand, there were so many hundreds of people dying publicly on television with refrigerated trucks at the medical examiner's office right in the center of the city. Everyone knew it. Something tragic was happening. But at the same time, Chicago somehow persuaded itself that the deaths weren't really real, that the disaster was blown out of proportion. You heard Mayor Daley in that clip before saying, you know, don't blow it out of proportion. Mm-hmm. And when I came back to Chicago to talk to people, and I just began my research on the heat wave, I was struck by how many people just couldn't accept the reality of this event. And to this day, I think the thing that's so troubling for the city is that, on the one hand, we know there was a great disaster. And on the other hand, we really don't want to go back and look at what happened and,
right.
and why so many people died.
Yeah, as you've described, so much devastation and, you know, so little attention at the time to just the, you know, how the depth of what was actually happening. It seemed like at the same time, life was carrying on. You had, you know, Clinton was president at the time. The O.J. Simpson trial was captivating audiences everywhere. Another Daley was mayor of Chicago, as you mentioned. And then at the same time, we have 98 degrees on July 12th. Was that not strange?
I don't think that the city responded to the heat as the public health crisis. It didn't seem that strange. Mm-hmm. And one of the really difficult things about heat waves that makes them different from other disasters is, first, the heat is invisible. It doesn't make for spectacular imagery. Like, we're all looking at the pictures of the floods in Texas this week. It's devastating. You can't get that image out of your mind. But if you close your eyes and try to picture a heat wave, almost nothing. Maybe you see kids playing in a fire hydrant.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that for so many people, the heat is an inconvenience. You press a button in your home, you turn on your air conditioner, and everything seems to go away. Or maybe in your car, or for affluent people, you drive to, you know, some other place where you can get away. That's just a ritual of summer in places all around the world.
Right.
And so I think for a lot of people in Chicago, it was hard to accept the reality that blistering heat mm-hmm. and high humidity is not just an inconvenience. It's a lethal threat, especially for people in the neighborhoods in Chicago that are most racially segregated, most impoverished, and have the greatest numbers of people who are alone and in trouble.
So talk more then about, you know, some of the things that we could not see that were sort of, you know, beneath the surface. The system here in Chicago was overwhelmed, right, Eric? I mean, the ambulances, hospitals, Cook County Medical Examiner's Office, police even.
The infrastructure of Chicago was overwhelmed. The political system was taken unaware. Go back 30 years to that date, and because there wasn't this kind of conversation about climate change that we have right now, it didn't seem like the kind of threat that called the attention of the leaders of Chicago. The mayor was on vacation. The health commissioner was on vacation. The fire commissioner, who is in charge of paramedics, was on vacation. Chicago had a heat emergency plan on the books in 1995, but they forgot that they had it, and no one activated it until it was far too late. And you know, as you said, overwhelmed on many levels. We had a clip of the power outages. Our grid was not up to the demand, and that remains an issue in Chicago and cities across the country.
What was ComEd's role back then? You talk about the overwhelmed power grid, but what should have happened?
Well, I think we learned in 1995 that unless you make constant investments and make sure that you have a grid that's as resilient as possible, you're structurally going to be in difficult conditions when everyone turns on their air conditioner at the same time. So I think there was a failure of preparation, a failure of investment, but that has been the case for decades in the United States. We have not built 21st century infrastructure in most of the country, and I fear that's something we're really not going to do now with cuts to support for renewable energy sources. So, you know, Con Ed was overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And when the power goes out, that means that if you're living on a high floor of a building and you need to get an elevator to your apartment or down from your apartment, you are trapped. It means that if you live above the fifth or sixth floor, the water pumps won't work, so there's no water. A lot of people in Chicago were in trouble because of the power outage. You know, that said, when I drew maps and looked at who died and where they died and why, it was less a story about who had access to power and mm-hmm. more a story about social cohesion and social isolation and which neighborhoods created conditions that helped neighbors check in on one another and which had conditions that were just far more perilous.
Yeah, I'm glad you went there, because what's interesting is that you can actually take a map, as you mentioned, of the heat wave related deaths. You're looking at neighborhoods. You can also take another map that looks at, you know, lower income neighborhoods where there's, you know, poverty, neighborhoods that are under-resourced. You can lay them on top of each other and they kind of mirror each other, Eric. So talk more about the areas specifically that you're talking about and the correlation there that you saw.
Well, everybody listening to this program knows that the zone of concentrated disadvantage and racial segregation and vulnerability in Chicago are on the South Sides and the West Sides. And that is true for a whole number of public health issues, and clearly was true for the heat. So I want to say at the first level, those maps are totally predictable, and they raise the question, you know, why is it, if we know which places and which people are most vulnerable to a crisis like the heat, or later COVID, why don't we do more in advance to protect those communities and make sure that we're doing everything possible to protect life? That's the first level. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say that as true as that is, I think it's abundantly clear that the heat wave was a case of environmental justice or climate injustice, where you can see the fault lines of the city playing out just as we would predict. I think the most exciting scientific discovery for my book is that I looked much more closely at those patterns of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And one of the surprising things I learned is that there were actually a number of neighborhoods on the South Side that were overwhelmingly Black, that were disadvantaged poor, and that surprisingly had among the lowest death rates in the city. They were more resilient, to use today's language, than many communities on the North Side that were whiter and more affluent. And when I really drilled down, I learned first, race and class mattered, segregation mattered, but at a deeper level, what really made the difference, what explains why some segregated neighborhoods did poorly and some did well, is the social infrastructure, the public spaces, people's access to gathering places where they could get to know their neighbors, where they built relationships. And in neighborhoods like, say, Auburn Gresham, where you have a lot of segregation, a lot of poverty, but a lot of social infrastructure, people had a system for knocking on doors. They knew who was old, who was mm-hmm. alone, who needed a check-in. And in like the neighborhood across the street in Englewood at the time, which in the mid-90s was really kind of depleted and impoverished, a lot of empty lots and abandoned buildings, people were much more at risk of being socially isolated mm-hmm. because the public life just didn't support that.
And so, that was a huge part of the problem, wasn't it? And affected seniors.
And I would say, back to your original question, what's the thing that sticks with me? There's the puzzlement, the denial, but there's also just the overwhelming fact that hundreds of people in Chicago died alone. Mm. We discovered something about the extent of isolation in a city that prides itself as a city of neighborhoods, of strong social ties, of communities. We live in a time when there are more people who are living alone and aging alone than ever before. And that really creates challenges for communities that want to protect their loved ones.
Listening to you there, Eric, it's maddening to think of what that was like at the time. At the same time, then Mayor Richard M. Daley, as we said, he did what a lot of people were calling downplaying. Let's hear a little bit more from him.
It's hot. I know. It's very hot. Yesterday we broke all records. I hope we don't break records. I mean, we all have our little problems, but let's not blow it out of proportion.
It is a crisis.
It's hot. It's hot out there. We all walk out there. It's very, very, very hot. It's like getting heavy snow. It's like getting real cold weather. Yes, we go to extremes in Chicago. And that's why people love Chicago. We go to extremes. We'll get ready for winter. I mean, I'm ordering all the salt possible. It could be stacked up to the Hancock Center. I mean, we're pulling it in now. But, this is extreme. And it's going East Coast, and they're going to have the same thing.
You really have to wonder, where some of that seemingly neglect came from too. As you said earlier, Eric, heat waves are not something that you can see, news cameras can't really show pictures of that other than what would probably look like a fun time for kids playing outside. And it's treated then differently in the media than hurricanes or another major weather event. In this case, with a heat wave, we don't see the threat until it's actually here. And that's too late, right?
Well, I mean, that is true, although that's not inevitable. I mean, if you think about what happens when a hurricane is coming towards a city, mm-hmm. the weather channels put those color-coded maps on TV for days in advance. We all watch this storm and track it. We learn the difference between a Category 3 and a Category 4. Like, it captures our political imagination and our public conversation. You could do the same thing with the heat, by the way. And it turns out that heat waves kill more Americans in typical years than hurricanes, tornadoes, and floods combined. So it does raise the question, you know, why don't we turn the heat wave into a more camera-ready event? There are things we could do. That said, I think what a lot of critics said at the time when Daley sounded so glib and dismissive about the severity of this thing, you know, joking that we go to extremes in Chicago while hundreds of dead bodies were at the morgue in the center of the city. I mean, could you imagine that kind of political response if the 700 people who died were on the Gold Coast in Lincoln Park?
No.
You know, in Bridgeport. I mean, you could not.
It wouldn't have happened.
Imagine that response. And many people I quote in the book were incensed about this. It's why they named this. One of my key interviews with a guy who led the paramedic response and was not able to get access to the additional paramedics and ambulance that could have come in from the suburbs had the city called an emergency. Mm-hmm. You know, he called it murder by public policy.
Right.
Murder by public policy. And I wish we learned our lessons in Chicago and also in other parts of the country in a way that could have helped to save lives in later events. Honestly, when I look at the floods in Central Texas this week and I hear people saying, how could something like this happen? How could so many people die so fast? I think, you know, there's a lot that we could have learned to protect life.
Mm-hmm. So when Robert Skates, who you were quoting there, who was the then deputy chief paramedic in charge of Southside Emergency Services, when he says something like that, murder by public policy, do you think he has a point?
I wouldn't have quoted him if I didn't. I mean, it's murder is a strong word, and it's not going to hold up in a court of law. Mm-hmm. But I think the point here is that this was not a natural disaster. This was a political crisis, and we, through our neglect, through our will not to know, to ignore, to forget, we made the 1995 crisis much more deadly than it needed to be. And we have failed to protect people in Chicago and in cities around the world from future crises because we have chosen not to learn as much as we could have. Do you know that the city of Chicago never held public hearings? There were never city council hearings on what went wrong with the heat wave response, even though they didn't use their own heat emergency plan. And do you know that when the mayor published his special report, his kind of group that he's handpicked to do a commission on what went wrong, the cover image of that report had an image of a snowflake on it and did not have the words heat wave. I mean, this city has tried to bury it. And
are these conclusions that you came to since writing your book, or were these pretty evident right away?
Those are the conclusions in the book. You know, the book goes into great detail to describe day by day the things that the city did and didn't do. Most of the quotes that we just listened to from city officials are in the book, and as is a discussion of the commission and the snowflake and the city council's refusal to hold hearings, which is a sign of a really, dysfunctional local political system. I will say that in subsequent years, later mayoral administrations, many city leaders have tried to think much more seriously about what happened, have tried to learn the lessons. And look, everybody in Chicago now knows that when there's a heat wave, you know, the political leaders talk about it, the media talks about it, we warn each other, we call for checking in on neighbors, things like that. But the underlying issues that make the heat wave so deadly, first, the change of the climate, just the warming of temperatures, now that's not something the city of Chicago has done all the things it could do to prevent. And also, it's from my perspective as a social scientist, those underlying social conditions, the profound inequality and racial segregation that makes people in Chicago so much more vulnerable on a day-to-day basis and in emergencies than they need to be. Now, we have shown very little political will to address those problems. And I think the heat wave is important because everyone in Chicago knows that fact about Chicago. We try not to talk about it. And then we had this 1 week 30 years ago where that should have become vivid for everyone,
right?
The consequences of this kind of arrangement. And instead of calling attention to it, we just turned away.
So we'll be marking this deadly anniversary all week on the program, and something we'll be tackling is whether we are prepared for something like this to happen again. So if, in your view, if this happened again today, are we more or less prepared?
Some ways in which we're clearly more prepared. As I said, no mayor is going to accuse the media of blowing it out of proportion. The political leaders would hopefully come back to town.
Right.
They would call an official emergency alert. I think media handle this much more responsibly. There's no more frying eggs on the sidewalk and running articles in the Tribune about, you know, how to wear makeup on a hot day. You know, we take it seriously as a public health hazard, and that's great. We activate a whole set of emergency responses to try to get check-ins on people who are most isolated, most vulnerable. And, you know, I think the city is trying to do a better job of creating better cooling centers where people will want to go.
Mm-hmm.
That said, is Chicago structurally in much better position? I think not, because
The systems failures might echo what we saw 30 years ago.
Look, that was a heat wave in 1995 that lasted about 3 days. In Europe in 2003, there was a heat wave that lasted 3 weeks, and the estimates of the death toll are around 70,000. It's just a matter of time before we get a 1 week or a 2 week or a 3 week heat wave in Chicago. And one can only imagine how that would stress our social systems, our public health infrastructure, our capacity to have the city function. And if there's anybody listening who thinks, oh, the Chicago power grid is going to be fine in a 3 week heat wave, or the Chicago hospitals are going to be fine dealing with all the people who come in, or Chicago's social system, our safety net, our neighborhood watches are going to be strong enough to deal with the kind of crisis that climate scientists think are more likely.
Mm-hmm.
I have a bridge to sell you.
We'll leave it there. We've been speaking about the heat wave that killed more than 700 Chicagoans that happened 30 years ago this week with Eric Kleinenberg, who's the author of the book Heat Wave. Eric, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Maha Ahmed. It was edited by Daniel Tucker and mixed by Micah Yasin. Every day, Reset brings you conversations to help you better understand what's happening in our city and beyond. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll meet again later today.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.